IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm your host, Mihir Mahajan, and today I have Sridhar Krishna and Arushi Kataria with me. And we're going to continue some of the discussions that Sridhar and Arushi have been having around jobs and cities and issues around that. So given all the news around what metaverses are and metaverse companies attracting attention all through the year, and through the pandemic period, many of us have been working remotely due to the restrictions on movement that have been imposed worldwide, a question starts to arise. Why do we need cities when many of us can live in the countryside that is so beautiful, has fresh air and better water, and there's a lot of space to run around and do things besides just being stuck in front of a desk? That brings to the question, why do cities exist? What are cities? And I know, Sridhar, you've been reading about cities a fair bit recently. Do you want to tell us something from your readings about what cities are?
Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot, Mihir. Yeah, I was reading this book, Triumph of the City by Edward Glaser. And he has this fantastic quote early on in the book. And I'd like to sort of read out from the book. He says, cities are the absence of physical space between people and companies. They are proximity, density, closeness. They enable us to work and play together, and their success depends on the demand for physical connection. During the middle years of the 20th century, many cities like New York declined as improvements in transportation reduced the advantages of locating factories in dense urban areas. And during the last 30 years, some of these cities have come back, while other newer cities have grown because technological change has increased the returns to the knowledge that is best produced by people in close proximity to other people. So cities really are about, you know, people getting together. It's not, when we think city, we think like tall buildings, broad roads, factories and restaurants and malls and everything else. I think those are all important, but I think cities are largely about people and the fact that people produce great things when they work together, and that physical proximity of people that, you know, allows them to collaborate in a much more effective manner. And I think that's really what cities really were meant for. And I think that's what they do extremely well.
Interesting you should say that, Sridhar, because all of us are recording this podcast from our respective cities, and not all of us are in the same city, and yet we are collaborating and working together. So the point that Glaser makes about proximity seems to be in some manner contradicted by our very fact that we are recording this in a remote manner. But given that Arushi is a person who has lived in cities all her life, and seems to think that she doesn't have much for the beautiful countryside that we were referring to earlier. Arushi, how do you look at cities?
So I think the way I look at cities is that they're a way for some form of human cohesion and coexistence. So I've lived in cities like Delhi, Bombay, and Chennai, and something that's been common to them is that you're in close proximity to people who are there to help you out, who are adding value to your life through something that we often refer to as knowledge spillovers. This could come in the form of often generic knowledge, but also in terms of more intricate things like culture, the way you even interact with people, the languages that you pick up in these cities. And overall, cities have evolved into just being more than places for production. They've become a place for amenities. So the kind of lifestyle that one lives and enjoys in a city is not something they could probably enjoy in at least the current suburbs in rural India as we see today. Which is also something that has been noted by urban economists, that at times the values that human beings place is not merely on where am I getting the most amount of money, but rather as your income increases, you start valuing amenities more. And the kind of amenities that cities give you, like say access to concerts or sitting and going to one of the best restaurants that you have in the country, or just being walking distance away from 100 different kinds of brands in a single mall. Those are amenities that aren't readily available to you in suburbs and rural areas. So if as somebody who's grown up around these amenities, not being around them seems very alien. So I think the value of cities comes from that. That for me, more than anything else, it's about the amenities that the place is offering to me.
I think it is interesting, Arushi, you should say that, because one of the theoretical points that urban studies has made over and over again is that cities act as agglomerations or agglomerative agents where people of various backgrounds live and can come together and have serendipitous interactions with each other that lead to creative, productive outcomes. Founders of various companies can meet on the streets of Bangalore or in coffee shops. It's less likely that they would meet in a smaller city because that doesn't have as many interaction opportunities between different people. As well as when new businesses start or older businesses need to transition to other kinds of work, it's easier for people businesses to hire, attract talent, and kind of have these kinds of varying demands for labor are easily fulfilled in cities because they are large agglomerations. People of every scale are available. Mm. But it isn't always true that all the cities are kind of always rising. In some sense, many cities go through decline and some cities rebuild and arrive in a new shape. Some cities decline more permanently. And that's something that we see around us. Sridhar, do you have kind of a sense of how maybe some examples of how cities decline and how some cities manage to stay relevant and grow?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at New York as a city, right? So New York is one of the greatest cities in the world, probably, if not the greatest. Right? And New York started off as a port city. And there was a time when, like, you know, the ships were small. But then as ships became larger, New York became they started following the hub and spoke model, right? So people would travel large distances in large ships and then, like, you know, transfer out to other modes of transport and travel inland and so on. And or like, you know, travel to other smaller ports in smaller boats. When that happened, New York became a huge hub and like, you know, and therefore grew in importance. And then because it was a port, it also made sense that, I mean, there are lots of raw material being transported from various places. They would come there. So it became a place where, like, you know, you would do garment manufacture, so many other things sort of took place in New York, and it became a place. But by the early 20th century itself, I think the importance of garment manufacture in New York started to sort of go down. People started manufacturing garments in China, as far away as China at some point. And then, in the last 40, 50 years, and then it became a little less important as a manufacturing hub, right? Because cities then, New York grew around the port. Then New York had these large factories which were doing garments. And then there was some things based on, there was some sugar factories and other things which were happening there. So those things helped in growing New York and its importance and in stature. But as manufacturing sort of shifted away from New York, and as the importance of New York as a port also sort of declined, then New York as a city actually went into decline for a few years. For about 2-3 decades, it was down. But then it reinvented itself in 2-3 different ways. It reinvented itself, one, in terms of while garment manufacture moved, the design and it still remained a fashion hub, right? So all the large, great designers of the world sort of congregated in New York. They worked together and they designed great clothes for the rest of the world. And they set the trend. They set the trend that the rest of the world sort of followed. And also in terms of finance, right? So finance became a big thing and New York became a very, very significant city in the world of finance. So I think between these two things, New York sort of reinvented itself, but it also became that's what happened to New York. Well, Detroit is another example of a city which was a big manufacturing hub but then failed to reinvent itself as automobile manufacture declined in the US and it sort of became smaller. So I think those are to examine closer home. Example of a city that that went into decline is like, you know, Kolkata, when it was the most important port in the British Empire. Then with Mumbai being sort of given as dowry by the Portuguese to the British, it sort of started, and Mumbai being actually a better port in some sense, it sort of became more important a port than Calcutta itself.
It's interesting you should bring up Indian cities and start your discussion with Kolkata, which was, I believe, a capital up until the early part of the 20th century. The British ran India from there. And also it was a port city. So if you were a person living in the early 1900s, 1910, 1915, Kolkata would be a much more important city to you compared to, let's say, a Mumbai or a Chennai at that time.
Oh, definitely. I think it would have definitely been a less importance. I mean, Mumbai and Chennai were less in importance than Kolkata was maybe in the turn of the 20th century. But
So what happened when the capital moved to Delhi?
When the capital moved to Delhi and the port was already, Mumbai had become a more important port. Chennai port was also sort of gaining some importance, even though it was not a... Chennai doesn't have a natural harbour, unlike Mumbai and Kolkata, right? So Chennai had some difficulty making its becoming a successful port city, but Mumbai definitely took over a lot of the work that Kolkata was getting. And with the capital shifting to Delhi, Kolkata's importance sort of reduced. And some manufacturing historically was there, and they continued to be there for another 40-50 years. But it's only by the mid-60s and 70s, I think, like Kolkata went into a significant decline from which it's found very difficult to recover.
I think, I mean, interesting, Sridhar, you should say that, because one of the themes that emerged from what you said is New York was a port city. And while it was an important port when it was a port city and it had manufacturing businesses, as you referred to, garments and sugar, and New York actually has a meatpacking district. So presumably there were other food-related businesses in the city as well. And then you mentioned that as the port, as the ship sizes increased and the port became less important, and as garment manufacturing either moved inland into other states of the United States or even moved abroad, somehow the agglomeration of people within New York found other things to do. They kind of moved from manufacturing to designing garments. They actually moved from the physical trade happening in New York to the finance happening in New York and the goods exchanging hands elsewhere where it was better suited. And somehow that process hasn't happened in Kolkata.
Yeah.
But in Bombay, I believe, again, Mumbai or Bombay, whatever you may call it, is presently undergoing some of these tensions of certain parts are declining, certain parts are rising. I grew up in Mumbai. So what I can say is, for example, in the 80s, when the mills actually started to shut down one by one, what happened in Mumbai is there was a decline. So if you still look at central Mumbai where the mill lands were, and absent good and coherent policy, central Mumbai has become this very odd mix of old dilapidated mill lands that are unused, then working class neighborhoods that have not received the kind of opportunity that they needed or deserved in order to kind of move employment in one generation from the clothing mills to some other form of employment. And then the third thing where some of these lands have been taken over and giant skyscrapers have come in place. And Mumbai has shifted from, again, the Mumbai port, while operational, is not as important. It has gone from being primarily a port city to now being India's largest financial hub, as well as an entertainment hub with all the movie production and television production and so on. But interestingly, Mumbai has kind of seems to be managing to reinvent itself in spite of public policy failures or lack of things, as opposed to other cities which sometimes don't manage to reinvent. So I think if we were to talk about that, Arushi, you have lived in Mumbai. Any specific, from your perspective, any specific takes?
I think it comes down to the fact that the way New York did, that they reinvented themselves, that the minute you saw that there was some production that wasn't as economical in terms of getting the people the wages that they needed or getting the kind of jobs itself, you sort of started a gradual or a sudden shift into something that you knew was in demand. And in a way, something that I have noticed is that over the last 20 years, the growth of services industry has been almost more than exponential. And that's what Mumbai has done, that it started as manufacturing with the clothing cotton mills, but it's completely transitioned into now going into more services such as you said, financial services, but also talking about more, you know, entrepreneurships are coming up. You have a lot more offices that you wouldn't have seen before. You have a lot more companies getting based out of Bombay simply because of the kind of labor pool that the city is attracting. So I think that's what Bombay has done, that it didn't ever center itself around just one form of economic activity, and it constantly kept evolving. And as multiple people have said, it's just innovation that keeps the city going, that as long as you have some form of economic activity that requires innovation, you will have jobs, and those jobs are going to get the highest premiums. And because you know those premiums are going to come, you're going to keep attracting people, and that's why the city keeps expanding.
Fantastic, you should say that. And I want to transition into our second theme now, which is we were going to talk about a metaverse as well. But before we do that, I have a historical perspective to offer, which is that humankind has had large cities all the way through history. But large cities, at least up until the turn of the 18th century, 19th century, by the time the 20th century came around, people were convinced the cities were going to be sustainable. But if you look at a history of London in the 18th and the 19th century, you will see a history of disease. You'll find that London used to be a place where plague was common, where other contagious diseases were common. And people were hesitant to live in cities, or people lived in squalor, the Dickensian squalor that we are all kind of familiar with. And part of the reason was that at least up until the 18th and the 19th century, we did not have as good an understanding as a society, did not have understanding of hygiene, and did not have the right technology to allow large agglomerations of people to live together in hygienic conditions. And I think over the last 70, 80 years, as our overall technology has improved, we understand hygiene better, modern medicine has made disease less likely or curable, we became more and more kind of comfortable with the idea of large cities. Only in the last 2 years to be shown up by a virus that's in our midst that has kind of locked us in our room. So I think it'll be interesting to talk about some of that and how our new technologies of online interaction and metaverse are allowing us to kind of get past some of these constraints that the virus has imposed, and also how that will transform cities. But before we do that, let's take a quick break. And on the other side, Sridhar, I would like to kind of start with you on how you see the pandemic influencing cities of the future. Welcome back, Sridhar. Your thoughts on how the pandemic has affected and how technology is changing cities?
Yeah, I think the first thing the pandemic did was it accelerated digital adoption in a very big way. I used to be doing a lot of work for clients on helping them with digital transformation, and business really boomed during all this, right? In terms of, digital was already becoming quite ubiquitous. At least all large companies were using digital, but what the pandemic has done is got even smaller companies in the most unlikely places, you've started seeing the use of digital. The amount of digital transactions which had initially started off with the demonetization, et cetera, has now sort of accelerated even further because people don't want to be exchanging notes, touching things, taking things back, et cetera. Using digital as a means of doing lots of transaction has become more common. The cloud has made access to data very simple. So it's possible now to seamlessly carry on the work that you started late afternoon at one in the office and then go sit in a coffee shop somewhere else tomorrow and continue the same work that you were doing. So I think while it has forced many people to stay at home and work, now many young people who lived in Bangalore, for instance, who were living away from their parents, had actually moved back to their hometowns. So that's a big shift which happened. I mean, we saw that whole with horror, actually, when we were watching on TV how all these migrant labor were like walking back to their homes, etc. But be that sight as it may, after things became a little better, people who had better jobs and could afford to fly, etc. So went back to their hometowns to spend the pandemic with their families, close to people they love. And some of it was because the work could be done remotely. People who are able to, who are in jobs, especially in IT and many other forms, where they were able to do their work from a distance, but managed to sort of live where they wanted to. But there are lots of people, like bankers, continue to go to work. They went to the banks every day. Retail shops, I mean, if somebody worked in retail, many retail outlets might have shut down, but those which were open, people went back to those stores and they had to work in offline. So the people who had to work offline sort of returned to the world that we knew earlier. But some of the people like us who work remote and have been working from home continue to do that. So I think that's what's really changed.
Because I think from Arushi's perspective, maybe it's a little bit different because Sridhar, you and I are office workers and have been for a long time. And we transitioned to working from home and hybrid. But Arushi, I believe you might have experienced some of this as a student, or you know many students that have experienced a sudden and dramatic transition from an in-person classroom to an entirely online experience. And I want to ask you that question in a slightly different way. I don't want to ask you to characterize that experience itself, but more importantly, think about how a city or how a physical university that permits students to come together for classroom as well as out of classroom interaction and what kinds of experience a student gets, and then contrast that with maybe what has been experienced for students over the last 2 years, where they are entirely interacting with each other online and participating in classrooms. Does the physical gathering or coming together or agglomeration matter to students and much more than, for example, senior working professionals?
So I think I barely went to college in person, probably just about 4 months out of my almost 3 years at college was spent on campus and the rest of it has been at home. And when we started out, the immediate change that we saw was that the online was impersonal, that the same teacher who was almost brilliant on campus, who could catch your attention from you standing outside the door of the classroom, could now not get your attention even though they were your entire screen. And I think over the last 2 years, that has changed, that people have learned to adapt to the online setting. You are now forced to be a part of a lot more collaborative projects than we ever were when we were on campus. We are almost forced into these interactions with each other, and that is allowing us to make new friendships. It's allowing us to expand our networks in ways that we probably wouldn't have, because what would happen if you were on campus? You'd probably be a part of a club or society and you would meet like-minded people, that you would hang out with people who shared the same interests. But now that you're being forced into group assignments where your professors make it a point to not group you with people that you already know, you're forced to interact with people who are not like you. And that's what cities did. That's what cities have usually done, but in a very, very subtle manner, that fine, you would be in a coffee shop and you could be sure that probably the next person who's sitting next to you does not share the same opinions as you, but you weren't likely to have that conversation with them. But I still think that where cities or physical interactions continue to play a role is building the depth of these relationships. That so many of these relationships can start while having an online conversation on Zoom or you having a conversation about assignments, but the kind of empathy and vulnerability that you end up sharing when you're in the same space, when you get the context of not just the same room that you're occupying, but also probably you're experiencing the same geography that you're sitting in, it's a lot more personal then. And I think I would like advocate that's why cities might just persist, because the feeling that you get when you're in the same physical space with somebody in the kind of amenities that you're used to, in the space that you're so comfortable in, I don't think that can be recreated in a metaverse or like through a Zoom class.
Interesting you should say that. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I agree. I like what Arushi was saying, and I agree completely. So while it's not very hard to do transactional stuff when you're working remote, right? So you can even do research, you can work on a project together, you can help in do some computer programs together, and you can collaborate. I think all that is not very hard to do. But what I found a little harder was to engage with new people. So if I've already worked with these people in the physical world, I've met with them once or twice, and I'm like working with them, it was easier to continue working with them remote. And you could still have the little banter while you wait for the meeting to start, or at the end of the meeting, you linger and you stay behind and have a little conversation with some people. You do those things. So that was happening. But with new people, getting some people who just joined your organization at this point, or people who have done something completely new, then that kind of engagement and interaction has become a little harder. People like Arushi said, initially everybody was struggling when it came to presenting online versus this. But I guess in my industry, we have done a lot of work remote and we have collaborated with global teams. So some of that was not very hard, but I think we were all in a hybrid mode. I used to travel 4 or 5 days a week. And then I suddenly went into a mode where we were just doing everything remote, right? So we did have to change a few things. But I think that part of it, the transactional part of it, was easy. I think that human relationship, building that closeness, all that became a little more difficult. And if you had a little bit of a discomfort or a disagreement with somebody, that got magnified during all this.
I think between the two of you, you've captured some of the key points or aspects that have been researched also. Because while the pandemic kind of brought all of this suddenly at everybody's doorstep, this has been a research area, particularly for people who research at the intersection of society and technology. And there's a research domain within computer science known as computer-supported cooperative work, or CSCW as it is known. And I remember about a decade ago or even longer, I read a classic paper in this field, and I wanted to kind of tie that together with what both of you said. The paper was titled Distance Matters, and it was based on in-depth research on investigating how teams that were geographically distributed and collaborating via computer systems actually interacted, what kinds of outcomes they produced, and what were the hindrances or hurdles that they faced, what are the key concepts that influence remote collaboration. And the paper actually lists out 4 aspects that are very important for effective remote collaboration to happen. The first one is common ground. So as Sridhar, you were mentioning that if you knew the people that you were remotely collaborating with, you had worked with them before, you had had a coffee before, or you had had multiple physical interactions with them, you knew what their likes and dislikes potentially were, and you knew where they were coming from with the point of view on the work, then there's already a common ground established. And if common ground is established, the paper argues that it is easier for people to collaborate remotely. The second aspect they characterized was something called coupling of work, which is that are you in a role or is the team composed of people who individually complete their own pieces of work, and then all of that gets coupled later on? Or is it a kind of work where people work together in a very direct manner? So to kind of take that as an example, the software industry has always worked remotely and lots of people write code independent of each other. But that's also very loosely coupled or almost decoupled work, because every person can independently work on their piece of the puzzle, and then all of it can get put together at a later time if your design is good. So coupling of work kind of worked in that fashion. Whereas if you think about, for example, work that, for example, people at Takshashila do, the think tank work is not decoupled at all. There's a lot of reading, argumentation, exchange of ideas that is required to produce creatively a research paper or a theme. And that requires a lot of coupled work, which is harder to do remotely. The third aspect is the collaboration readiness of the organization itself. Does the organization have works and processes defined that allow you to collaborate? Right, because a lot of organizations are kind of organized in a way where they rely on the physical presence, and then you shout over their shoulder and say, do X and do Y. And if you're not ready for the collaboration, remote collaboration, it's much harder to do. The last piece, which is actually what we'll get into towards in the next few minutes, is the collaboration technology readiness. And Sridhar, you were pointing out this out also, and Arushi has pointed this out, that the initial months as students was harder because the teachers were not ready for the collaboration technology, or students were not ready. But if an organization has technology readiness, and by technology, we don't necessarily just mean like a Zoom or a Microsoft Teams. It actually refers to almost every activity that you do in person, you have to be able to do via collaboration tools. And that's something that was that a lot of organizations were found wanting. So I think in that sense, like the lived experience as well as the research tends to align that there are specific professions, specific lines of work, specific kinds of work that is hard to do remotely, that requires common ground and so on. But there are also kinds of work that can actually be done via remote collaboration. And interestingly, we are now in a space where this remote collaboration so far has been people looking at thumbnails in a screen, but the metaverse actually allows you to physically embody, be physically embodied in a space with others. So instead of being thumbnails in a screen, you're going to be in a joint virtual environment with virtual objects in your hand, and you can actually play with those objects as a team. So in some sense, it seems to address some of these issues related to the technological hurdle in establishing common ground or having the collaboration readiness in some sense. So in that regard, I mean, coming back to that theme, it seems like we are on a kind of a technological change that might substantially impact how that happens and how that influences cities. So one of the things, Sridhar, I want to ask you is this hybrid mode that we keep talking about has historically been hampered because we have always thought of physical first and virtual or remote collaboration later. And so we have all had experiences of working late evenings from home, but then going for a morning meeting in the office and so on. And so when we had physical first and virtual later as the hybrid definition, is the pandemic experience and the new technology going to change that order? Is it going to be virtual first and physical later as a hybrid?
I think lots of companies had already moved into virtual first, physical next, right? So because of all the kind of technology that was already available through all those telepresence meetings that we would have to sort of reduce the amount of travel that was needed, the fact that we had large global teams working on projects together, which meant that being together physically was really not an option if you wanted the kind of skills that are available only in different parts of the world. And you want to put that together to deliver great value to a client in a particular location. So there would be like a local team which is actually meeting with the client physically, but the expertise is coming from a global network of professionals who are all over the world. So that is something for which organizations like Accenture, IBM, et cetera, had already put in place great technology. But nevertheless, even during the pandemic, even organizations like Accenture had to move 125,000 desktops to people's homes because there were all these people who were working from home. I mean, from the office and like at desks at work, not everybody had a laptop. Of the 200,000 people, maybe some people had laptops, but there were many people who worked at desktops at home in the office, and people had to be, I mean, the organization shipped computers to people's homes. So that was quite a big supply chain event, but it happened, right? So I think people needed to make that happen. But I think then internet connectivity was a big issue. I think that also was made available to people. So I think that internet connectivity, having technology, which we take for granted at certain places, is not so easily available even today everywhere. I think that's something which has now become, it has become more robust today in the last couple of years, but it wasn't the same initially. I think that's something to remember. And I think the metaverse will definitely make a big change in terms of how you work. Some of the challenges that we think cannot be overcome without having a city might get overcome by that. But I still feel that human beings need to be with other human beings for multiple things, including safety. Right. I mean, it started off, so one of the first reasons why people, human beings got together was to feel safe. That was the most important reason why they were together. And that doesn't go away just with technology. So that's number one. I think that's, and cities are places where they're more cosmopolitan. They're not like, they're culturally a much better place for people to be, because you can mix with people of different cultures, and you're more free. You're less constrained by the norms imposed on you by your community, your family, and so on and so forth. So I think cities give you that anonymity. So I think many of those aspects will probably continue to be there well into the metaverse. I mean, I think that's my take.
And in terms of, I mean, you talked about very important aspects of what cities offer that's irreplaceable in some sense. But how will, for example, either of you can answer this, is within cities, will the landscape of office spaces, universities, establishments, will the design change in some manner? Will offices, for example, become less places where you go and put your head down and work for 8 hours, and more places of where you go and meet people and get to know them, establish the common ground, establish the collaboration processes, and kind of use time together more for human engagement and activity, and instead of kind of trying to focus on raw productivity numbers, which can actually be delivered from remote collaboration? So maybe, I mean, is that kind of physical design something that's likely to change?
Yeah. I think one thing which will first of all change is, like, in organizations which were not looking at outcomes, but were looking more at people's presence at work, right, and activities, I think that's going to change. People are going to be less bothered about what activities you do and more concerned with outcomes themselves. So I think that will be like a big change in org design in organizations which have not gone that route. The other thing that I do see, and I agree, I mean, see, if you're in if you're producing steel in Jamshedpur at Tata Steel, I think you still need to be in the plant to produce that steel, right? But there are a large number of people who support that whole process. I mean, there will be people who are designing it. There are many people in the lab. There are people who do various things, some of it which can be done just from home. And those people may not have to be in that particular location itself. So I think organizations will change in terms of how many people need to be at work. If there are 100,000 people in an organization, there will be like maybe 20,000 who need to come to work every day. There may be another 20,000 who will come to work maybe once a week in order to perform a particular transaction. And the other 40, 50,000 people might require, maybe 10 or 20,000 may never come to work at all. And the others, 40, 50, might come to work once in a while just to meet other people and to get a sense of belonging and to feel part of the organization. So organization design will definitely change. I think so. First of all, the number of seats that you need, physical seats where people sit at a desk and work, that will change. That will reduce. But there will be a need for more meeting rooms and like, you know, cafeteria kind of in interactions, more open spaces, more conference, auditoriums. Those kind of spaces will increase in offices. So office design will definitely see a significant change with all this. So Arushi can probably tell us about universities.
And homes, because one of the things I've realized is like, as more and more people have got desktops at home, the size of the average Indian home as it is small, the number of rooms and the type of design we have. And with multiple people working from home and children at home and students of universities studying from home, one of the things has been that. So Arushi, I mean, from that perspective, both from the university as well as home, what do you foresee? Or do you foresee that in a single home, people will be in 2 rooms in 4 metaverses?
I mean, I can say from personal experience that is very, very possible. So we have 3 rooms and it's like I'm in 1 room and my parents are each individually in their own rooms and you don't see each other for the whole day, and then you convene for dinner. You go like, okay, we were sharing the same space. And I think that is pretty much what has happened during the pandemic, that work from home has taken over. So there was a study that was done in the US economy in the early stages where more than 2/3 of the GDP around that time was being generated from these kind of jobs that were largely being done from people who were working from home. But again, the point is that work from home jobs come with a lot of inequality within them, that all of these jobs mostly tend to go to people who are highly educated and highly skilled. So when we're saying that work from home is here to stay, we're saying that these jobs, which already didn't actually require people to physically be in a space are now realizing that you don't need that infrastructure now either, and you can save on the capital that companies would have expended on creating a large office, trying to show investors that we have this space, and you don't need to do that anymore. But I think the bigger question is, does it really change anything for the other kind of jobs that exist in an economy? And the way that is looking at it, essential services went back to fully functioning as before, they almost never paused. You had construction stop for a while when there were restrictions on how many people could gather, but now they're back in full swing and there's been almost no change in how construction work is happening. And that seems to be pretty much the case with even, the hawkers on the road or any of these employment opportunities where you have highly low-skilled or unskilled workers with low levels of education. So for them, the geography of jobs has pretty much remained unchanged. They are back to doing what they were before the pandemic. So I think maybe the geography changes for those who have the skills, who are educated, but not so much for the other people.
I think that's a good point. What's likely to happen, though, is as the geography of work changes among office goers and among people who can work remotely and so on, the geography of other kinds of jobs is also likely to change. So taking a Mumbai example, as the number of commuters and the commute patterns change, the stores and the services that come up to serve the commuters and to serve people who are going to office and do chores while coming back from office and so on is going to change. I mean, for example, digital payments has changed a lot of things. We have gone from having to stand in queues to make payments for various things to having apps for them. And so therefore, those entities have disappeared and been replaced by other things. So as commute patterns change, as people's mobility patterns change, we might foresee neighborhoods of different kinds. I mean, traditionally, we have had neighborhoods with homes and smaller stores, but we have hardly ever had really office space. Under Indian law, only certain kinds of professionals are allowed to actually have office space in residential areas. But now that everyone's working from home, we may actually foresee neighborhoods of apartment buildings and smaller apartments and so on. We also have office spaces within them. We might have buildings that are actually combinations of these spaces. We might have areas that are combination of spaces that allow for leisure activities, work activities, manufacturing, food, all kinds of things kind of happening in similar neighborhoods. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of difference. And then maybe within that, there is the metaverse opportunity for you to be in the metaverse for 2 hours in the day and collaborate with your colleagues or go to the university. And then the remainder of the day, you may be in a physical space with somebody playing a sport or maybe actually engaging in cooking or other manufacturing type of activity. So I think it's an interesting challenge for urban designers, for economists, for planners to kind of look ahead and try to think about it. And I hope today we got a start about kind of thinking for those issues. So Sridhar, any kind of closing comments on this?
Yeah, I think how we live and work has constantly changed, right? And they will continue to change. But the reasons why people get together and stay together and people congregate and will remain. So I think the future continues to be in cities, but the cities of the future will be different from the cities of the past. And the way we work, we may not need it for work, but we will still need it to meet each other, get to know each other, and to actually live. I think those are my views on cities and the relevance of city, continued relevance of cities even into the metaverse era.
And Arushi?
I think I agree with that too, that cities will persist and they might persist for a wide variety of reasons. It could be that people are particularly drawn to the fact that they provide them with access to networks of people. It's providing them with access to amenities. It's providing them with all of these positive externalities that we associate with living with so many people, as you call them, agglomeration forces when we began. And I think that's exactly why they will persist. And maybe they'll just be artifacts of people who've actually lived in cities and haven't experienced a world without them. But I feel like at least for our generation, they're here to stay.
Interesting, interesting. And thank you both for that perspective. What I would like to say in closing from my comment would be that in the past, we've had cities grow and decline, as Sridhar very nicely kind of outlined for us with New York and others. But we have often had cities kind of make the transition from industrial cities to service-oriented cities or various other kinds of transformations. But each city had faced its own share of challenges and economic transformations. And while cities like London and New York also came out of pandemic-like situations in the previous centuries, what we are seeing today is a very interesting phenomenon where all the cities around the world are facing the exact same issue with the pandemic and therefore are going to have to come up with solutions for this. And as work transformation, as technology has spread worldwide, a certain class of professions worldwide has shifted into hybrid or virtual modes, as Sridhar pointed out. And for those professions where there was reluctance to send jobs to a remote location before or allow people to work from home, because that barrier has been broken down, it also creates an economic opportunity, especially for us in India, where we have a large talented pool of talent that could actually tap into this global opportunity that has emerged. Because if work can be done remotely, and then a talented person should be able to get that access to opportunity irrespective of their location. So from an Indian perspective, what I would like to kind of see is, one, our cities to face this challenge creatively by kind of saying, in the post-pandemic and online collaboration world, how are we going to reinvent our cities? How are we going to make the right policies to allow our cities to play that enabling role that cities have historically played? But then second, on the economic front, how are we going to use this opportunity that has been created by this sudden transition in order to generate and provide more employment for our people, given the advantages that India has through all the different aspects of our population? So I think that's a challenge that needs to be investigated, and we need to address it. And the relevance of cities will continue, and hopefully we'll be able to take this opportunity to get jobs into India in that regard as well. But thank you both very much for joining today. And I think it's a terrific discussion that will continue. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.